Thank you for joining us today for Only God Rescued Me, My Journey from Satanic Ritual Abuse. I want to thank everybody who has been supporting this podcast and listening and praying and sending me your support and your encouragement along the way. If you would like to support this podcast, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/onlygod, and you can buy coffees there for $5. Or at the last Wednesday of every month for $10, I have a question and answer session if you would like to get in on that. Also, you can go to Anchor or Spotify and sign up $5.99 for a subscription to Lisa's World, where I will be going into more intimate details of my life and my story and my journey and where I am today. So you can start an account there. It'll take you, I think, 24 hours once you open your subscription for it to become available. And I just want to let you know that that's out there, and I appreciate all of you. Please hit subscribe if you get a chance. Have a good day. Welcome to Only God Rescued Me. I'm Lisa Meister, your host, and I am absolutely delighted to bring to you Elaine today. She is a survivor and overcomer, a victor of SRA, and has a ministry called Lydia Discipleship Ministries that have been working now for almost 30 years, reaching out to survivors and bringing healing and deliverance and training. So welcome, Elaine.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I really appreciate you coming on. You have so much wisdom and experience to share, and I just can't wait to hear what you have. Can you tell us a little bit about your SRA background?
Yes, my family background is from Finland, and spiritism in the actual tribe. They have different tribes up way up north back then, and the actual tribe that our family had as a generational ancestry is known for its involvement in the occult. And so both sides of my family, both grandparents on both sides, were actively involved in the occult, but they believed that it was just spiritism. And I think the difference is, in spiritism, people are fooled into thinking that the powers that they're using must be from God. That's what was the assumption in my family. Whereas in the occult, people are no longer tricked. They know who they're serving and who they're worshiping. So because of the occult involvement in my home, then there was that strong SRA component. And of course, the DID is part of that.
So was it completely dissociated and repressed for you?
It was. In my autobiography is called Laura, and there's one chapter in there where I keep saying my body is trying to tell me what my mind is trying to forget.
Oh.
Because the clues in my body, scars or whatever, were evidence of something that I had no memory of, because the dissociation was complete and also the amnesia was complete. So as I would see things, I would just ask myself, well, I wonder what that's from. But then very quickly, I just moved on. It was as though my mind didn't really want to know or didn't really want to think it through clearly.
How old were you when you started understanding? Like, was it flashbacks, or how did it come back?
The flashback started when I moved away from the farm that I grew up on and went to college, and being away from the spiritual forces there, I think made it so that the covering of their work began to erode. So I would have flashbacks.
So in college, wow. Do you know, like, was there like a stressor, or like, do you think you felt safer? So it started, because it's kind of younger than a lot of people experience it.
I'm not sure, other than the fact that the area, that the rural area that I lived in, was itself very steeped in the occult. And so I think just the spiritual dynamics of being away really helped to make it so that the Lord's timing for consecutive flashbacks was just his timing. And I really feel that about triggers even, that as someone's going through the healing process, I think the Lord orchestrates when the triggers are allowed to be evidence and come forward, because it's an evidence that the Lord, that particular trauma, it's time for the Lord's healing of that specific one.
Yeah, I think you're right. Although it's very hard to see them then as a positive thing.
Right.
Yeah, because we tend to run away from them. But well, face it,
I think they come at inconvenient times.
That's true.
One of the strategies that I used, and I think for some people it's helpful, is I was seeing a counselor at the time, and I was at that point able to hold down a part-time job. So if I were at work and I was being triggered all of a sudden, if I would say to the inside, well, you know, my counselor, he's going to want to know about this. We're going to have to tell him about this. And I would very strongly let the inside know that we weren't going to push it down or try not to be triggered, but we were going to delay it. And that seemed to be a helpful strategy, so that in the middle of things, you know, it didn't have to destroy it. Although I have to tell a little story. It wasn't funny at the time, but it sort of points to the absurdity of the life that we lead when we're finding healing. I was teaching at a college part-time, and it's a small town. And as I was going into the grocery store, I saw a lady coming toward me. And I must have started to get triggered then. And just as I passed her, I said to her, "My father has a crack in his head."
Oh, wow.
And then I thought, oh my goodness, you know, this professor here is, and the lady just looked so horrified and scared, and she just hurried right along.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can't avoid the embarrassment.
Oh, I know. Dissociation is a difficult process to get on top of and figure out and heal from, mm-hmm. which is what your ministry focuses on. Is it more the dissociative parts of things?
Right. We do emphasize dissociation, and it sort of is a two-pronged ministry. Years ago, we had more individual offices where we had pastoral counseling and specifically DID counseling. But as the years have changed and people have retired and this and that, now we emphasize training, only training others rather than meeting one-on-one. And probably on our website, about 85% of what's on it is to train people to know how to help effectively. And then the last, what would that be, 15%, or am I not counting right? The rest would be help for individuals. And I think the Lord always uses our past to put us in unique places of ministry. I sort of see his kingdom as a vineyard, and he assigns different rows to different people. I've never been married, so I can empathize with the betrayal that divorce brings. But somebody who's been divorced, there's a unique understanding about it, and their platform for ministry is different. Likewise, if you're in the DID realm, and using the past helps bring a level of understanding that make it easier for people to trust you. We have a series of, 20 or so, we call them tiny talks. They're just about 5-minute videos that I made over the last 30 years. You get to see my hair color changing and my weight going up and down in these different pictures of me for the last 30 years. But I deal with topics that would be important. So I speak directly to someone with DID and discuss things like, why doesn't God heal me faster? Or how can I go to church? Or how to find a safe counselor? How can I make friends? And the platform for the information on that, of course, is not only my own experience, but having worked with DIDs all these years, to see on a level of understanding that we start from. And I found that people have a greater ability to absorb what I'm saying or absorb or the feeling that I'm a safe person so they can listen to me because of the background.
Right. Safety is exactly what we need more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And for survivors, it takes a while to build that trust, mm-hmm. which I know there's a lot of ministers that want to jump into helping, you know, but they kind of tend to scare people off with, you know, not understanding that. How do you find churches in general as far as their receptivity to SRA survivors?
Well, I hate to say that in 30 years, I don't know that the needle has moved very much on the little register thing. Maybe in the last 5 years, there's been a bit of an openness. And there are some churches that are doing a good job. And those are the kind of places, individual ministries within them or counseling ministries within particular churches that we reach out to or that reach out to us because they have suddenly come to a situation that they have no idea how to help this person.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you need help. I know as a survivor, and then I talk to so many survivors that we're complex. Mm-hmm. We're not easy to minister to. So you got to really have God's heart.
You have to have God's heart, but you also have to have God's calling.
Yeah, absolutely. I was wanting to talk to you today about the survivors. There's so many. I talked to a lot of survivors at the very beginning of understanding that they're an SRA survivor, and they go back and forth between, yes, this happened to me. No, it didn't happen to me. Yes, it happened to me. No, in it, you know, we all go through that. So I was wondering if you can explain, if you understand why that happens.
Well, it's the DID isn't a mental illness, but the brain is very actively involved in it, having to do with the place in the brain, for example, that decides if the brain is going to dissociate. And then if that decision is made, then other areas of the brain are notified of the, you know, what they should be doing while this trauma is going on or while the memory is being placed in the subconscious. So I can understand the power of the brain to choose dissociation as a substitute for insanity, because I believe it's God's gift, especially to children, because the level of trauma, it would make the brain implode in a sense. It is so horrific. There's no place for it in the normal tallying of the events of the day or memories. One of the things, strategies that I encourage people to use when they're playing ping pong with their memories, you know, yes, no, yes, no, it's like playing a game of ping pong. One of the things that I encourage them to do is to make the commitment. Whatever's true about the past, I choose to believe it. Because otherwise, the enemy gets them distracted about the issue, yes, no, yes, no. And you're always looking for proof, you know. And unfortunately, many of us have very little proof. Others have, you know, have in their history much evidence that, yes, this did go on. But I think not being sidetracked is something that we can encourage, because at the right time, it will come together and your brain will agree. All the places in your brain will agree what happened. But until that point, you really can't will yourself to decide.
I know with me, when I finally hit that point, I am going to just take it as true and I'm going to see where it goes. And it seemed to me like, and I'm not sure what exactly caused, I think I was so tired ping-ponging, I was just exhausted, but I'm not sure why exactly I did it, but I know that healing started going a lot faster at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's complex.
Sometimes finding parts inside that if you simply ask them, what do you think? Did it really happen? Sometimes hearing them say yes is an encouragement to sort of push you more toward the realization that it did happen, because the inside ones know, whether they remember right now or not, they know.
How does one get to trust the insiders? So like all of a sudden this information starts coming to you. You've never heard it before. How do you learn to trust that?
I think there are ways to sort of test it. That might not be the right word, but say, for example, that suddenly, you know, you remember an incident with the pastor and you're thinking, well, the pastor is just a really nice guy. I mean, you never would do anything like that, is to get around the conference table inside and get the opinions of as many places, as many parts as you can by asking them, well, what do you think? Is what so-and-so's telling us, does that seem true? What do you think? And it's not that all the parts won't be deceived about it. They may say, no, it didn't happen, but giving them a chance to be heard strengthens, I think, the feeling inside, either toward, yes, the more I pray about it, it just seems like it did happen, though I don't remember it right now, or the opposite way, like, well, I know the enemy's a deceiver. Lord, you know my commitment to only know truth. So I ask you to make it so that the truth stays and anything that's not true would just disappear.
Do parts ever lie to us?
Yes, because they're trying so hard to tell themselves that it didn't happen.
Yeah. It's complex. And then, you know, I know for me, having parts that were trying to make the things I was forced to do okay. You know, it's mm-hmm. like I had these parts saying, well, we like this. We want this. And then other parts saying, no, we don't. We don't want, you know, it's very confusing.
Well, sometimes I call it the war within, because there are those parts, often the protector parts, of course, that are, their job is to make things seem normal, quote unquote, that things didn't happen. And then often the little ones, I think, I'm not sure why, maybe because their emotions aren't so regulated the way as we've grown older and those places in our brains have taken on more of a rational approach to things. But many times the little places in our mind are the ones who speak more truth than the protector or those that have an agenda, like you're saying, where they've told themselves, well, the reason this happened to me was such and such. And because it happened, I probably liked it or wanted it. So they convinced themselves of that.
For somebody who's very new, there's so much anxiety. There's all these parts and they're giving you all this information. How can a survivor deal with that anxiety, that ping-ponging, you know, while we're in that mode, what's some things we can do to calm down a little?
Well, I think that's why having a trusted friend coming alongside, whether it's a lay counselor or a mentor or a discipler, can be really helpful, because we can bounce off sometimes just the tip of the iceberg. We can bounce what we're thinking off of this friend. We realize that if we told them the totality of what was going on inside, they would be overwhelmed. But the things that are important to us, as we tell them, for example, well, you know, there's some sexual stuff that I just don't know what has happened. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff going on, you know, a level of friendship where you can discuss even things like that. And they can just simply reassure us that they have heard us and they understand. They don't have to have the solutions, which especially in the early part, you're not really ready for solutions because there's so much inner chaos.
Right. So, do you know, have you been able to get any kind of an idea of how long this section of healing can take? Just that whole ping-ponging time?
Well, in general, the overview that I have in my mind, not for the ping-ponging part necessarily, but in general, 4 to 5 years of doing some really hard memory work, you know, with a counselor or some other trusted person. That's sort of the framework that I have, but it's always hard when you say a time thing, because people say, well, I've been going for 12 years and, you know, this, that, and the other. So it's sort of a rule of thumb, I guess, is what they call it. But in terms of the ping-ponging, it correlates with what the mind is doing. The mind is beginning to remember and define the reality of their past, and then the normal response of denying that anything happened, and then the mind, you know, brings things up again. I think that the person can be helped by being encouraged about what to do with the fear, and to ask, I often call it kind of the end game question. If you carried this thought all the way to the end, what would that mean? You know, so if they're ping-ponging a lot, saying, well, say that it is true, what would that mean? All right, let's say that it's not true, what would that mean? So giving them a framework to sort of think through and clarify, what would this really mean? Because that's where their fear is. They're afraid that, you know, I'll go crazy. They're afraid that if I remember, I'll go crazy. I'm afraid that if I remember, I'll kill somebody or whatever the fear is.
Yeah, I think I had such a fear that it was true that I was trying to make myself, oh, I must just be crazy. Mm-hmm. Because in my mind, that was better than being a survivor of SRA and accepting what that meant.
We have a video that, or not video, it's an audio, we did years ago in connection with a group of our ministry that would give away CDs, or back then cassette tapes, of different issues that they might find in their parishioners, but they might not know much about. And one of them was, they came to us asking us to do one on DID. So that if the pastor was sitting across from somebody and they said something about having DID, then he could give them this cassette, and it would contain information that maybe he himself wouldn't be familiar with. But we titled it, You're Not Going Crazy, because that's so prevalent and so prominent. And we've heard reports where it was sitting on the desk of a pastor, and even before the person who came in said anything about DID, they right away gravitated to it because that was the main issue that they were so afraid of.
Yeah.
I always say that if you didn't go crazy when you originally went through it, you won't go crazy by remembering it.
Right. I had a psychiatrist tell me early on, because I was convinced I was going crazy, and he said, people that are going crazy don't know that they're going crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, rats, that's off the table for me. I mean, it was comforting in some ways, but in others, I was still coming down on the side of it is better to be crazy than to be a survivor. But again, we're always there with the mental health and like maybe that's still ping ponging. You know, what are my options here? And that's, we all go to, those are our options.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people would look at this ping ponging and say, see, that's evidence that it's not real.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say about that?
Well, when the thought that this did happen comes, if it's something that is transient, in other words, it's there for a little while and then we don't think that anymore, as opposed to the thought that it happened. And especially as Christians, as we pray about it and ask the Lord to confirm, did it happen? Especially as we pray about it, the longer we do that, if that idea gains strength, then that in itself to me is an evidence that probably that is true. Whereas if the thought is there and then we're maintaining that, but then it gets very weak and, you know, then we think, well, I don't know what's going on. We just sort of advocate, is that the word? I'm not pronouncing it right, to just not decide.
Just kind of leave it there.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of somebody having SRA flashbacks, but then finding out that they were not true, that never happened to them?
In the 30 years of ministry I call survivors TOGS, T-O-G-S, Trophies of God's Grace. That's the word I use for survivors. I've never had that experience and I've never seen it.
I think that's a really important nugget for survivors to hold on to.
Mm-hmm.
Are there tools for survivors in these early stages that you would recommend to help get them through?
Well, I don't mean to keep mentioning the things we have, but those are the things I'm most familiar with.
Well, I want to hear what you have.
Years ago, we had an intern that came and she helped us develop Abby's Safe Place. It's an interactive website, and we did it about almost 20 years ago, back when there really weren't, the only interactive websites were, they had Charlton Heston reading the New Old Testament or something like that. But it's a Swiss chalet, and you go into it, and the goal is twofold. One, it's a place to belong, because of the isolation that you feel so strongly. And the other thing is the emphasis on appropriate discipleship materials. And each room in the house, you go in and there's a playroom, there's a good shepherd's room, there's a kitchen, there's a computer room, there's all different kinds of rooms, and each room has a different focus. For example, I think it is in the parlor, I'm not sure, the emphasis is on relationships and how to make friends. So we've linked it to articles and to different websites. And I think the aspect of having a place to call your own, in a sense, or to belong, is really powerful. There's, for example, you can draw... Abby was a cat that I had for 19 years, so that's Abby's Safe Place. You can go in the kitchen and draw a picture and put it up on the refrigerator, just like you would if you were in a family and as a child. But you have to have Abby check it out first so that it's not scary to anybody. So then it goes on the refrigerator, and then we have an art gallery. So it gets moved from the refrigerator off to the art gallery. But I think one of the most powerful rooms is the playroom. And because you can't be with your counselor 24/7, and sometimes having a counseling session stirs up everything inside. And in the middle of the night, you can't call them necessarily, but you can go in the playroom anytime 24/7 and break the bubbles from our anger wall if you want to, or make a spirograph of something, or listen to Focus on the Family, reading children's stories. One example, I think it was really precious because it took a lot of work to get it together and also to maintain it, is when I was in England ministering. I always met with a lady from Wales. She would take the train over. And when I came back one time after several months, I got an email from her, and she was so excited. She said, every time after my sessions, I'm so stirred up. I always self-abuse by cutting myself. But she said, for the first time when I came home, I went to Abby's playroom and I played for a while and it calmed down. And she said, I did take a pen and write on my arm things like I'm stupid and I'm dumb. But she said, it's the first time I've never self-abused afterwards.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, all the work that we put into that was worth it, even just for her.
How can we access that?
It's Abby Safe Place, all one word, and it's spelled ABBYS, and then SAFE, and then PLACE. At Lindy, is it? Oh, Lindy's checking for me.
Homestead.com.
Abby Safe Place. Homestead.com.
Wonderful. That'll be helpful. That'll be really helpful. I know a lot of survivors right now. I'm like, ooh, I got to get this to them. That'll be very helpful. How can a survivor find a counselor or a minister who is safe? That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has to be that the Lord leads them to a person, obviously. But there's so many people that have quick answers, and those aren't safe people. And so as you talk to people, trust your instinct. I think intuition is a God-given discernment tool. And if you're unclear about it, you know, taking a survey of the inside is sometimes very helpful. You know, who thinks we should go to this person? You raise your hand or whatever. And in terms of locating a person, I'm just trying to think. There are different ministries, like Deeper Walk is one, Marcus Warner's ministry, and Thrive, Jim Wilder's ministry, who are aware of dissociation. And I know Marcus Warner in Deeper Walk has a referral list that he uses. And that might be one place to look.
Wonderful.
It is a difficult situation because, you know, it just grieves you that there are so few people that are willing to jump in at the deep end, which is what you need to do with DID ministry.
Yeah, because I get survivors all the time. Can you point me to somewhere? And the good ones that I find, I max them out so quickly because you can only take so many, you know, and it does take a long time.
One point too, though, is when I first started, my abuse started when I was two. And when I first begin to have the flashbacks or whatever. I didn't have a counselor for maybe 7 years, except I had one who was called the Wonderful Counselor, the Lord. And sometimes, I don't mean to minimize his effectiveness, but sometimes if he's the only one we have, it's enough for that time.
The name of my memoir is Only God Rescued Me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that was all, you know, for most of us, that's all we had
mm-hmm.
for so long. Mm-hmm. Although I think as we heal, it's good to have a team.
Oh, definitely.
How do we build a team around us?
Well, I'm not sure that it's the responsibility of the wounded person. That's why we emphasize so much training teams. And I think if you feel that nobody's building a team around you, the first place that you want to go is to find a person who is a gentle prayer, somebody that knows how to pray and is gentle. And that's the first person to build on your team.
I like that.
We emphasize like a full-blown team is made up of 5 people. And it's in the church context that we're talking about. We have a discipleship program that is DID friendly. And almost all our materials are DID friendly. And that means even if they don't specifically mention DID, they're written in a way that wouldn't be scary for people with DID. There are a couple of resources that we put a little warning on you. This might be too intense or whatever. But the R&R program is a rebuilding and renewing. And over the years in the different churches that have had that, a lot of the, well, usually about a third of the class typically were people with DID. And it starts out with a module called Getting to Know the Father. And we purposely use the word Father rather than the Lord or Christ, because that's the core, a real core spot of harm and anger and pain. And then we do This Changes Everything, which is, I think it's a 6-week study on learning how to trust God. And then we do a Taking Every Thought Captive, learning how to be spiritually aggressive so that, especially if you're from SRA, you don't get tangled up again in things. But that kind of a program, we recommend 5 parts. One is a teacher, but it's a specific qualities. It's a teacher that doesn't, for example, mind a challenge to their faith or doesn't have all the pat answers down. I was teaching in a class, an R&R class, and the woman that I knew had DID, she kind of just burst, interrupted, and said, "I think God the Father sucks." And like, if you were in a regular kind of Bible study, that would have been a little bit of a problem.
Yeah.
You see people looking at each other kind of thing.
Right.
Well, thank the Lord, when I said quickly, what should I say? He told me to say, given your background that I know about, I can understand why you believe that. And then I just went on teaching. Well, if you've got somebody like, you can't be using that kind of language, you know, what do you do? You know, that's not going to work. Another part of the team is a friend for that teacher, because the challenges that you run into, it's important that that teacher have a friend. And then a couple in the church that are retired that can give a sense of belonging. Their kids might be in other states, so they can invite people over on the holidays. But also they can give appropriate hugs rather than, you know, the 22-year-old youth director getting involved and maybe going down the wrong path. Another one is that prayer that we were talking about, a person that knows how to fight in prayer, how to do spiritual battle. And then let's see, that's four. I'm trying to think of the fifth. Well, it's written on our website. I'll just say that. I can't. A counselor, that's right. An appropriate counselor. So, and that's the makeup of the team that I think is most influential.
I really like your using an older couple like that. That is brilliant. Yeah, because they can really minister.
Yeah. And they can notice when someone's not there on Sunday.
Right.
You know, they can just build that connection with the church.
Yeah, because as survivors, we tend to be runners. You know, get a little triggered, we're gone. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be nothing happened or it could be something huge happened. We can't mm-hmm. discern, you know, so we're just out of here. So having someone that can gently check, mm-hmm. are you okay, is a mm-hmm. nice thing.
I had a good thing happen when we got a new pastor in our church several years ago. And I don't know where he learned about it or whatever, but some of the people that had come through the R&R program, they joined the worship team or they were involved at a passion play. And, you know, that's very intense, the passion play situation. And so as we were having rehearsals, why this dear friend was walking down the hallway and the new pastor came and said, "Oh, hi, I'm Matt. What's your name?" And she said, "I don't think I know." And he said, "Well, that's okay." And just went on, you know, and I thought, oh, we need more pastors like that.
Yeah, we certainly do. We certainly do. I am just really amazed by you. I really like the information you have, how you've put it together, and how you are helping survivors and just normalizing our very chaotic experience.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's, again, like I said, the Lord using each of our pasts in such unique ways.
I like how God does that.
Yes, he doesn't waste anything.
No, and he also, does not.
Also, you know, I've been reading in Revelation and specifically looking at the chapters that have to do with God's justice. And there's five words that come out of that section. And it says, God has appointed a day. And I like to remind people that no one got away with anything. You know, we have a God of justice.
That's, you know, it's not that we want revenge, but right. Knowing that justice is there, to me, says that what happened to us mattered.
Mm-hmm.
Because that feeling of nobody cared, nobody stopped it, nobody's held responsible is like, nobody sees me, I'm invisible, I don't matter to anybody.
I remember I put it in the end of my autobiography, Laura. When I was in first or second grade, we started going to a church, and the Sunday school teacher, I think, had theology a little bit mixed up because she said, "Are you ever afraid?" Well, I was remembering what made me afraid. And she said, "Well, if bad things are happening, pray and God will stop the bad things from happening. And if you're afraid, pray and God will keep you from being afraid." So I knew what men were coming on different nights of the week. And so for Rudy to come was terrifying. And so I prayed that he wouldn't come, but he came anyway. And then I prayed I wouldn't be scared, and I was terrified. So off and on during, it had to be maybe, oh, I would say maybe even 20 years. Off and on when I was praying, it would pop into my mind and I would say to the Lord, "Lord, why didn't you honor the faith of that little girl? Because she really believed what her Sunday school teacher told her." And there was no sensing of him telling me anything. Well, I was teaching at another university and I was driving there. And I had asked the Lord that question that morning. It just popped in my head again. But as I was driving, God answered me. And of course, I had to pull over and call them and say, I didn't want to say, I can't come to work because God just spoke to me. But I just said, I won't be able to make it into work right now. But he told me four things. And it was really powerful. At first, he said, every time you prayed, I heard. And I thought that was so kind of him to say that, because I remember as a little girl thinking, maybe I didn't pray right because I didn't pray out loud. And I don't remember if the teacher said I had to pray out loud. So he said, every time you prayed, I heard. But the second thing was brought me to tears, because he said, every time you wept, I wept.
Oh.
And then he said, the third thing was, there's no way you can understand why I let people choose good or evil. Your brain isn't made for that, to know that. But the fourth thing he said is, I think what he often says to all of us, he said, do you trust me? And I think that's the focal point that we come to in our healing. And as we find healing, we can find more and more of a connection with him in a deep level, so that we know he weeps when we weep, but we also know that he can be trusted. Sometimes when you're talking to the inside ones and you're talking about the good shepherd or somebody, and they're very frightened and they say, well, I know he's talking to my other sister or whatever they call another part, but I'm scared of him. I always encourage them to go behind a rock and just peek at him and see what he's like. And so often, right away, there's a beginning of an important connection, because he is trustworthy.
Absolutely. And those are really deep questions, because for some people, it becomes an insurmountable obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
So I like how he helped you through that.
Yeah.
What would you like to say to survivors who are listening today?
Don't give up hope. If you run out of hope, find somebody that you can borrow hope from. I often tell people to borrow my hope. Hope is a necessary ingredient when you're making, I won't call it a smoothie because the healing process certainly isn't smooth, but when you're mixing up stuff in the blender, hope is an important ingredient. But it's really easy to run out of hope, because hope is an emotional thing, and sometimes you feel like your emotional tank is running dry. I often just ask God to top it off, like they do at Jiffy Lube, you know, is to top off my hope and top off my ability to handle things emotionally. The other thing is the sentence that's very true. It won't always be this way. I made a list called Then and Now, and it's 50 things that are different now. And it just lists things like, then would be nonstop suicidal thoughts, whereas now I don't have any of those. Then would be staying awake for 5 hours listening in case any footsteps came. And now I can just go to bed and sleep, and I'm not afraid. And if you can encourage yourself even that it will be different later, and it will kind of be hard to imagine how good it is actually. But I know when you're in the middle of the painful process that healing is, sometimes it's hard to hang on. There's a verse that says, the Lord is the one who holds my hand so that when I fall, I will not be hurled headlong. So it's not that I'm holding his hand. He's holding my hand. If I'm holding his hand and I fall or stumble, then that's it. But if he's holding mine, then there's that connection.
That's beautiful. What would you like to say to society?
Well, I'd like to isolate the Christian society first, and that would be don't be afraid to believe that God can remake any life, even those that seem so chaotic, so bizarre, at times so unbelievable in what they're telling you. You've never had any experiences like that yourself, and it's a stretch in your own mind, but asking God, how do you want me to show what you're like to this person? Because it says, it's kind of an old word, it says we're ambassadors. And I'm not sure nowadays what an ambassador does, as much as realizing that he speaks on behalf of a nation, or he speaks on behalf of another person. So if I'm getting my job description right as a believer, I'm supposed to be doing things that show other people what he's like. And whether that involves getting training to minister to the most shattered, or if it involves learning how to be compassionate even when I run out of compassion.
Very good. Would you like to say something to the non-Christian sect of society?
Let's see, what would I tell them? You need to take a chance on knowing the one who you often deny right now and don't believe exists. But watch what he's doing in people's lives, things that nobody else can do. Just watch him and then decide.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Elaine, for being with us today. Just so much wisdom. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And if for all the Elaine's autobiography and Abby's Safe Place and the Lydia's Discipleship Ministries, I'll put all those links in the show notes so everyone listening can find them and get to you.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye now.